Okay, morning. Good welcome to the Entrevista interview with Raj Nair, founder, chairman of the international consulting firm Avalon Consulting. Raj is a parallel entrepreneur, which means that he runs several businesses at the same time, and not an easy thing to do. And apart from Avalon, he also founded market research services firm Ugam Solutions and the artificial intelligence software firm Germinate. Now, we will start this interview with a very fascinating, very trim and dapper Raj Nair, who I'm told outruns people half his age in his very inspiring and people get awestruck when they see his office in Bombay. So, Raj, you know, let's start off with your story. First and foremost, welcome to Entrevista.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Okay. Now, Ugam Solutions, one of your parallel companies that you started, you know, we'd like to start with that because a very fascinating story of something which pivoted so fast. It started off actually as something called Productorium. You got it from idea to actually prototyping and as a company in 50 days flat. You also got funded for that idea, but in just about 50 days, you completely exited that idea. Just walk us through this process of this, what is today known as rapid pivoting, failing fast, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, actually, I didn't know about these terms. Probably they were not even mentioned in those days. We set a 50-day target for a very simple reason. This is December 1999, rather late in the day to enter the dot-com wave, and we wanted to do something in the internet. So we said, look, we don't have all the time on our side, so why not think of something which is good or appears to be good, and if it's good, do it fast. Mm-hmm. So the best way was to set a very, very stiff target in terms of goal to complete. It sort of inspires everyone into action, and almost every day you can measure. If you don't measure it, and you can see the happiness of succeeding, that you plan two steps and you complete those two steps in the day. And those are days we hardly slept. You know, from idea to a company with a ready product and service, 50 days, I don't know whether I want to do it again.
Okay, now, you know, but what made you then shift, you know, after creating a baby incredibly within less than 2 months, what made you kill that baby so fast?
Oh, well, it is simple. It's one thing to be a green-eyed entrepreneur chasing the wave of the time, another thing to be an astute businessman. It was very clear in a few days' time that the idea which we are pursuing, that is comparison shopping, mm-hmm. leading to another backend subsequently, is not going to take off for at least 5 years in India. It is too early in the, the game. So we burn a lot of money for 5 years and eventually succeed, but by then we will have a huge baggage of accumulated losses. Mm. We said, look, this is not our. You're not building a business to make losses. Even if venture capital was prepared to fund it. So we just said, okay, we are halfway through this process of building it, we realize it's not going to work. We said, we'll complete it. And on the day when we did a presentation to the venture capitalists, they were very impressed by what was done. They liked it and they said, no, you know what, it's not going to work. He said, why don't you present it to us? We think it will work. He said, no, I don't think it will work. If you're interested, really, in us, fund our CV. If you're prepared to fund our CV, we'll come up with something sensible. They just took a few minutes and said, yeah, done. We'll fund your CV. We'll put the money in your bank. Make sure you use it sensibly. So there's a big responsibility to make use of the money sensibly. And what we knew was market research. And we said, internet, global connect, speed. Why don't we then do what we know, is market research. How about bringing the analytics part of market research to India and doing it out here, and there's data transmission and not a problem anymore. So that's how we went from this sexy dot-com thing to a very mundane but powerful business model.
Now there are two things here, you know, which kind of leap to my mind. One is heady days of the dot-com, 99-2000. People at that time were talking cash burn.
Yes.
Don't worry about revenues. It's about building a business, inverted comma, whatever that meant. And the second thing is, a person like a venture capital, you know, placing faith in a team which didn't have an idea. How did you manage this?
We had a track record as a consulting firm, and which did strategy as well as market research. So there's a certain amount of credibility for the team. Secondly, the finesse with which the product is developed and completed also built a fair amount of confidence that these guys can do what they want, set out to do.
Mm.
The team of young people were absolutely brilliant. So it was very evident. So it's not easy to get a good team. So when you know that here's a good team, they're honest guys,
mm-hmm.
and they once they set out to do something, they'll do it. When money is chasing ideas and not ideas chasing money, which was the situation at that time, it was pretty evident that it's worth backing. And we said we're going to think through very carefully and use it for a business that will succeed.
Then something interesting happened that the VC said, you know, you said you wanted to buy back your stake from the VCs, and at that time it was contra-intuitive because most people are looking at providing a combined exit kind of thing. Why did you choose this option of buying back, and how exactly did this whole thing work out? Did the VC make anything out of it?
Yeah, see, the VC's fund was getting over,
mm-hmm.
and they needed exits from businesses, so they were exiting as much as possible of their first fund.
Mm.
They knew fully well that this is a business which is growing and making money. In fact, we made money from the 14th month of this cash break even. So they knew that this is a good thing, but they had compulsions.
Mm.
So they said, we have to sell it, we don't like to sell it. They said, in that case, how about working out an arrangement with us to buy it off? And we ultimately bought it out with our own internal generation.
So the internal generation 100%. Now, you know, Raj, for that time when people were talking cash burn, don't worry about making revenues, you stuck to the straight and narrow traditional path of a true businessman who always looks at generating cash flows, generating surpluses, making the business self-sustaining, self-sufficient, which is even today many times not what many people think. You know, it's okay not to make money for the first 3 years. Where did you get that rigor and that discipline, and what's your advice to many of today's entrepreneurs as well?
See, it's a simple thing. You start a business with the idea of getting a return on capital employed. If you're not going to get that, there's a problem with the business. Even if it's somebody else's money, ultimately you're responsible to get returns for the investors. So looking at the profitability of the business you do is a done thing. Over the years, one has realized it's not just profit and loss, but you have to focus on cash flows. So, if I were to look back at 2000, I would say one is focused more on P&L rather than cash flows. Today, one will be focused more on cash flows, because automatically a P&L will come. Mm. You won't get cash flows without it. There's no point in building a business, not a P&L, but all the money in debtors and this and that and no cash flows. So, being a management consultant for over a decade and having worked in a bank earlier, one was clear that, look, at the end of the day, what talks is profit.
Right. Now, another very interesting thing is you already had another company, Avalon Consulting, and then you started Ugam. And, you know, always these fellows who fund you from outside, whatever name you call them, VCs, investors, whatever, have this worry about this conflict of interest and where is the key management time going. How did you kind of figure out to, you know, how to convince them? How did you figure out that, you know, you can satisfy all these stakeholders?
Neither the VC nor we realized that is a conflict of interest, there is a problem. We clearly said that this is a new business. So that there's adequate time and attention place, we'll have a twin strategy. We'll keep Avalon out. The founders who are part of Avalon will spend adequate time at the board level. We will have a full-time CEO and a team under there who will actually execute. In most businesses that works. Ownership and management you separate and it works. So we're very clear that we wanted to build a solid business. Not by putting one leg here, one leg there and making a mess of it. So while I was executive chairman, there was a lot of freedom given to the CEO and the rest of the team to build the business. And outstanding people.
And did you also structure some kind of equity arrangement with all these newer team members so that people felt that you were walking the talk and actually made sure that they had skin in the game?
Okay, there are two things. First of all, the CEO was not a hired CEO. There was another team of entrepreneurs, two brothers, two cousins, who were also trying to get into the business. We said, why don't we put the business together and make it one? And as a consequence, and you guys run it. I'm very passionate about running consulting. I spend my time there. You run it, you build it, and we work together. So automatically, share was there. There was another youngster from Avalon who was just a year and a half in the company. He was selected, let's say, to build a product for him. And the deal with him was, look, four of us will invest from Avalon. You're going to be one of the five who are going to work, or probably a major part of the work to be done. So we will divide this four into five parts and you'll get one part free. So you got 20%. So today he's worth a lot of money, but he's earned more than that. So there was skin in the game.
Okay, because this is very interesting for many younger entrepreneurs also to figure out that you can actually build different kinds of businesses by actually creating and investing in a team. That's basically what I'm getting from you. Now, the other part of the equation was the VC, you know. And since you had no prior experience of taking outside money, what exactly did the experience teach you about working with a VC in Productorium stroke Ugam, you know?
See, the VC today is different from a VC of 2000. Okay, those were innocent days. You did the right things, you did worked on trust and so on and so forth. Today, if you want to deal with a VC, you've got to deal in a very, very formal manner. And you are preparing 300 pages of documents and then arguing about this clause and that clause. That was a different situation. You won't believe, we had this VC telling us, okay, we're going to fund the team. And then we said, look, you know, we don't want to go through 3 months of documentation and arguing a legal thing. Let's sit together in a room, start at 9 o'clock. We don't leave that room till we finish all the documents, even if it has to spill over to the next day. It was agreed. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, everything's sealed. There were the lawyers on both sides, the VC, the entrepreneurs. We said lawyers can't talk, only the entrepreneur and the VC talk. What they say in English will be translated into legalese. That's it. So there was no conflict or arguing about legal niceties. We knew what we wanted, they knew what they wanted, we knew what was expected of us, they knew what was expected of us. It was a fantastic one day. And as I said, the world was not so complicated. So they didn't have to take 100 things. And today if you take funding from a VC, maybe 100 CPs, conditions preceded. Now you spend the next 15 days to 2 months trying to comply with the CPs. And at the end of it, you see. So I'm saying that those are innocent days, these are much more rigorous days.
But do you think, you know, the focus has in some way shifted from building a business to, you know, satisfying a legal agreement? You know, somewhere you think that the fun is being taken out of this whole game and excitement of building a business?
I think if you're dealing with a good VC, the VC will make sure that that doesn't happen. Especially if it's a VC which is comprised of people who have done businesses, set up businesses and sold. If it's a VC who is just coming with a financial background, what you say might happen. So even in the next venture, when we are looking for a VC, we wanted to deal with some people who actually have built businesses and sold. So they know what it takes to build a business. They know what the pangs of the entrepreneur are. They can actually support and they can see their point of the entrepreneur's point of view.
So what you're really saying, from what somebody else told me, was that if the chemistry is right, the arithmetic will take care of itself.
Absolutely. Well said.
Okay. Now, we've talked about your, you know, we've jumped somewhat into the middle of your entrepreneurial foray. But we know that sometime in your past life, you did something called an IIT degree. And at that time itself, you know, in the initial days, you wanted to become an entrepreneur. What was the background that you had, you know, personally, and what drove you to you know, get this entrepreneurial spark?
Yeah, actually, when I started IIT, it was very clear that I'm going to the US do a PhD and become a scientist and all kinds of good ideas were there. But halfway through the IIT course, I said, look, 1 month become an entrepreneur. One had gone to so many factories as part of the factory visits and so on. But everywhere there was absolutely no innovation going on. What was dictated by Germany, the principles in Germany or in the US, had to be done. Even R&D was a testing lab in most places. It was a joke. I said, look, what are we all studying so much for at various institutes, not just the IITs? And if you're not going to use it, so why not actually... So here's a country where, in the manufacturing sector at least, hardly any innovation is happening. So if you want to innovate, it's an opportunity for a business person. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to do something and try to do something innovative. But by the time one went to IIM Ahmedabad, one realized engineering and manufacturing is not the only thing in the world. There are lots of other things. It really opens your mind significantly. That's what the MBA does. That's when I realized, actually, services business probably suits me more. One problem I have is that people think that my view on ethics is too black and white. I don't like anyone sailing close to wind. I don't like anyone taking a step, even a slight step away from rigid ethical rules. But that's possible for you to do in business if you're in services. I'm told by my friends in manufacturing that there are hundreds of inspectors and it's not possible to remain purely ethical. So I'm more comfortable in a space where I can say no and say get lost, I'm not going to be enticed or forced or into doing anything which is not considered to be ethical. So services business gave me the opportunity. It is perfect in the sense that there are opportunities to innovate, opportunities to create business. You don't have to do any nonsense. You can keep your sheet absolutely clean and enjoy it.
Now,
a day's work and a good night's sleep.
Now, one of the things that seems to come out from your response is exposure. What you talked about, exposure through factory visits, exposure through different kinds of learning. Do you think a lot of entrepreneurs suffer because of this tremendous lack of exposure? In India particularly, where we don't even have a liberal arts kind of orientation, we don't allow experimentation. Do you think that itself hinders a lot of entrepreneurs?
I think so. I completely agree with you. And you've been an entrepreneur, I'm sure you also felt the same. If you don't get exposure, you're not likely to see what are opportunities and you don't see what are the things you should be doing. So one of the things I said to myself when I was at IIT is that I will work for 5 years anywhere. Primarily, the objective is not to go up in that organization, but to understand how organizations run, understand what bosses shouldn't be doing. Because as an underling, you can see behavior patterns of people which are destructive, behavior patterns which are very constructive. And there's a lot to learn from those people and those situations which come in extremely handy. So I'm saying there's a great school called experience if you're looking for learning. If you're going there in the morning and coming back in the evening and say, I've done my job, then sorry, you're not going to get anything out of exposure.
Now, after you worked first as a merchant banker with ANZ, Grinley's Bank, which is now folded into Standard Chartered and all that, what made you set up the company that you today have in 1989, Avalon Consulting, or its precursors, you know? What made you set up this particular variant of services and how did you go about getting your first few customers? Walk us through that initial few
Before
days.
Before setting up the consulting company, I set up a market research company, which is B2B space. See, as a merchant banker, one had seen so many reports. Now, I won't name companies, but I didn't think terribly highly of the reports. And I found that maybe these guys are, not that they are not good, but they are constrained by the amount of fees they charge. Therefore, they are not able to hire great people, cannot do a great job. I said, no. Here's an opportunity, because I'm saying that in India, you're saying the quality of market, B2B market research is not what it ought to be. And when I did my numbers, I said, look, if I need to that kind of to do that quality, it's going to take much more effort and probably much better quality people. So I said, let me hire society types or any good institution, don't compromise on quality and charge double the market leader's price. So on day one we started, we said my fee is going to double the market leader's price. Doesn't matter if it's got a shock impact. And then we hired people who are not people who are required for market research, but for a higher thing. Fortunately, both things worked out: the higher fee and the quality of people they were dealing with. It just worked out. There's only one company, a multinational company, which says, "Sorry, we can't pay you 100% premium over the next highest quote. 70% if you're prepared to settle for fines."
So, really speaking, it took off in the manner that you envisaged. Did there any course corrections that you had to make in your model or kind of customers you attacked?
Actually, no, if I look back, I would have had to make a lot of course corrections. Had it been not for the fact that, say, first 2 years, there will be no discussion on vision and goals and sales targets and profit targets, nothing of sort. So, look, the principle is, how can you create an organization in a market which is not considered, not delivering high quality, but how can I do this? And if it takes 2 years, so be it. It doesn't matter what revenue, what profits. And obviously some profit had to happen. Luckily, the fact that we were able to get away double the fee gave us a lot of margin. Margin play, I wouldn't say margin. And then we were able to invest extra, go home with a decent margin, but deliver much more value. So it worked.
Now, one of the things
was, when I didn't have to be, there's nothing, no course to correct. We're saying we're going out and we're going to do something like this. And it's not as if there's a straight and narrow saying target of this. We didn't have a business model even. So today you'll say, laugh and say, well, how stupid, how can you not have say a vision, how can you have no goals, no business model, etc. We'll figure out how to do it.
Do you think that's a good approach for many entrepreneurs who have the intent of being an entrepreneur but haven't yet quite worked out what exactly they should do about entrepreneurship, to kind of get in, kind of put their toes in, get their feet a bit, experiment a bit before crystallizing? Would you think that's a good approach, or do you think that there are different strokes for different folks?
The second part is absolutely true in any case. But I'm just saying that there's a difference between chaos and experimentation. If you know what you want to achieve by experimentation, by all means experiment. If you say, I don't know what I want to do, I don't know where I want to go, I think I want to go, then you like be like Christopher Columbus. He wants to reach India, no homework done, no work done even on the way whether he's heading towards India, and he landed in a place, luckily for him. But for every Christopher Columbus, I'm sure there were thousands of guys who got nowhere and sank. Sure. So I'm saying it's good to have the flexibility, good to tell yourself, because I'm not set my path, I have to every day wake up and check where I am. Am I getting anywhere? You can't drift. It would impose actually much more discipline than if you had a plan.
So what you're saying is a variant of, if you don't know where you're going, anyway will take you there. Don't feel like that.
May not get you where you want, but therefore you have a need to check every day, well, this is it happening or not happening?
So what the importance of placeholders played a very important role in your life
initially,
and I think initially.
Yeah.
But even after that as well, having some placeholders to tell you where you are and where you are vis-a-vis the stakeholders seems to be a very important takeaway from your experience. Now, one of the things that also interests me, being a person who's also been in a similar line of business, is the Indian market for some of the services that you were in has traditionally been quite small, very restricted. Did it really make sense to focus on such a market where there's, like we used to say, have the saying that the price of information is equal to the cost of photocopying, and you must have faced the same thing. Did it make sense to keep focus on such a market for so many years? Has it really paid off?
See, right from the beginning, we never offered information. The whole mindset, whether we were doing market research or doing this analytics has been doing Logan, or in consulting, it is always insights leading to solutions. So we never sold information one day in our life. So then there's it's the value proposition is completely different. And even when in consulting, when we quote, we say, look, in 18 months, how much value can I create? And is my fee less than equal to 1/8 of it? Very clear guideline. So what happens is the chances are that the client ends up getting 8 times or more value for the money they make. So we are lower of cost. So we never allowed ourselves to be positioned in any of our business as a cost. So the comparison with, okay, can I not get it free, doesn't arise. Because we are free anyway. If you're producing 8 or 20 times value on what somebody gives, and that too in a period of 18 months, then you can't be seen as anything but zero cost. So the shift is to value. So even for this thing I told you at the beginning, that we said we would double the price. Obviously you can't go to somebody and say, look, XYZ company is the biggest in this country, they charge X, you know what, we're going to charge you 2X. Just throw it out of the window, especially because we have no experience or name or reputation. So it had to be sold as value. And by the way, it was 2X. And why are we talking about cost?
Good. Now, one of the things that you did very early on, 4 years into Avalon, is to have a tie-up with OC&C Strategy Consultants to kind of bring a foreign linkage.
Yeah.
What was the rationale, and tell us how it kind of worked out for you guys?
Actually, a small correction. It is before OC&C, there was another tie-up called Catchers. See, when India opened up in 1990, it came as a surprise to many people. Actually, 2 years earlier, when we were consulting for BASF, buyer, who wanted to create a case for dilution under FIRA, we advised them that there is no way you should be doing it. We think that this country is going to liberalize in between 24 to 36 months. The simple reason is that every year we've got a deficit of current account deficit so much, our current amount balance is so much, forex balance, it can't last for more than 1.5 years. There will be all kinds of things done. You can stretch your life to 3 years. 24 months to 36 months, we will not have money in this country to pay a foreign debt. India is a country which is self-pride. It won't let that happen. It's the basic hypothesis. In which case, they have to change a lot of things drastically. And so one of the things that's going to change is this requirement of foreign companies having to have 40% equity. So they asked why. They said, look, if you don't have foreign exchange, are you going to ease out on barriers to foreign exchange and inflow? They want more and more foreign exchange to come in from the corporate sector and so on and so forth. So how can FIRA continue 3 years from now? They bought it and they said, okay, in that case, what's going to happen to us? It means that we're going to have a market where there's going to be competition, no more licensing. If there's competition, there's a need for strategy. We barely knew how to spell the word strategy. Didn't know much about it. They said, look, we can't get into a market and talk about strategy consulting without having some capability. We must tie up with some people who are good at it. So we shortlisted 31 companies, small firms around the world, who were formed by ex-BCG, Bain or McKinsey guys. I went and personally met at least about 18 of them. One of the most catchers, which we simply loved, they came to Mumbai, signed up, and we learned a lot of strategy from them, because they used to tell we did one big engagement in India, and which was highly appreciated by the client and by Catchers, the joint team. So they said, why are you wasting time here in India, and why should we form a joint venture to serve the Indian market, because the market's small, the rates are low, you send your guys across to the UK, each one will stay for 6 months at least, we'll train them and we'll put them on the consulting jobs with our cards. So there's no difference in exposure. So over a period of 4 years, the entire team got some absolutely amazing exposure. We finally learned what strategy consulting was. That put us in a different wicket. Simultaneously, McKinsey came here and raised the umbrella fees. So for us to triple our fee was not a big deal. So we learned what we didn't know, and it helped us to do things which we didn't know how to do, and we were pretty effective.
So having that kind of foreign engagement at that time and a tie-up substantially added to your capabilities and therefore to the value that you could provide to the clients.
We had hired people who should have been consultants and not market researchers in the very first place, so as to differentiate in the market and create value. So when it came to getting to strategy consulting, the team was there and the training came in extremely valuable, and so the methodology is used by McKinsey, Bain, all we learned and we adapted them, and so they were, it helped us, it's helping us even today.
So this year, 2014, you know, 25 years since you started Avalon, and what are the key things from your journey through these 25 years that you kind of learned, and what are the key things that you might do slightly differently?
Good question. That 25 hits you in the face, you know. And you said, how old are you, man? Yeah, you must have learned something along the way. Stop to think. Yeah, actually, every day is a learning. So there's so many things which one has learned, unlearned, and learned again. Because the world is changing so much. Second thing is that the markets we are catering to have changed. Earlier, we were catering to the Indian market. Indian market has changed. Today, we work in about 91 countries. So our market research division is spun off into a separate company called Avalon Global Research, which works in 91 countries. Our consulting company has done work in about 44 countries. So there's so much you learn about the world and different kinds of people, and the way you need to adapt to different cultures. So it's been a fantastic journey of 25 years, as you put it, where learning has never stopped even one day.
And what might you have done differently, or you're pretty happy with the way things have panned out?
I'm pretty happy with the way things have panned out. If I knew this journey is going to be so exciting and nice, maybe I would have put in a different approach to it, a more structured approach to learning. But I suppose that is point of fun.
As a person, what has this 25 years, you think, taken out of you or contributed to your becoming, inverted comma, a better person, you know?
Very deep question. Yes, see, I don't know, better person or worse person. When I started my journey, I looked at colleagues as professionals, respected them as professionals, and it's all about delivering results to the client. Today, I see colleagues as a person whose wife had a migraine in the morning and he had to deal with it before coming, whose child didn't get admission in a school which he deserved to get, but didn't. One understands how the environment impacts that human being's behavior and output and productivity at the workplace. So if I would use one word, I would say empathy. It can't be taught in business school. It's only 25 years for people, dumb people like me, maybe 5 years for some smart people. It takes time to learn empathy.
You know, I think there's a lot to be said for people who are very classically schooled, especially in these business or technical oriented subjects like engineering, MBA, you know, that where it becomes an input-output kind of equation.
Correct.
To figure out that there's a context and other kinds of variables as well.
That's why when you talk about liberal arts in the beginning, it just struck me, yes, that's something one missed.
I agree, you know. So the other thing which we haven't really talked about so far is this artificial intelligence company that you have called Germinate, you know. Where did that come from? I mean, it's completely different from what you're doing.
Yeah, it comes out of this curiosity. I take my newspaper in the morgues in the morning, it's 45 minutes reading it, upsets my wife, but now we've got more toilets than we, and people in the house, so there's no problem. So I was reading this paper when I was vacationing in Minneapolis with my son, at my son's house, and I saw in the paper front page top, some huge number of people had registered for this do not disturb on the telephone. You know, in the US you can't, there are many numbers you can't call and sell things you want to market research with. So that's increasing, and in Ugam, a lot of our clients, the market research companies, they collected data by calling up. 70% of US market research, consumer research, is telephone. Pen and paper is only 10%. And then there are other modes, online and so on and so forth. So if this happens, our biggest source of information for market research can die. And the information you get from people who are ready to answer questions, probably they don't represent the population, so it cannot be projected by a sample or irrelevant sample. So he said, look, market research is going to have a problem. On the same page at the bottom, there were some piece that said, oh, there were as many as 5 million blogs postings per day. I said, if 5 becomes 100 million, and if market research access to people on the phone comes down, maybe the way to do market research is to understand what people are saying in blogs and so on and so forth. You know, it's all before Facebook and all these things. And then maybe we should find a way to understand that information. So my son has a PhD in artificial intelligence and he worked in Honeywell and those. And he came back from work that day. I said, look, how about this? Is it crazy or is it possible? He said, of course it's possible. Except that in your conventional market research, you will interview 2,000 people. It's a close set, manageable set. And then you ask them standard questions, again a manageable set. So it's process driven and easy. But if you have a million people talking and you want to find out which of the 1,000 people are talking about the subject you want to understand, are you going to go to the 1,000 million people and then million posting then those? When it becomes 100 million or 200 million, what are you going to do? How are you going to find out who is relevant? Which conversation is relevant? And then, if there are 2 lakh conversations on the subject you want to do, are you going to read through all the 2 lakh and then do it? Totally unviable. So, if you use algorithms which are sensible and you create, you can manage it. I said, okay, you're looking at a technology company. And you say, yeah, not only that, you have to build up all the stuff ground up. And it's going to cost money. Are you prepared to be Santa Claus? Okay. Here I've become Santa Claus. 2007, he came back and it's been a very exciting journey. In fact, that's the business I like the most. Today, 102 brands in India are using Germany's product called Explicate to understand what they should be doing based on insights they get. For instance, there's a FMCG company which has developed a face wash. The inputs to R&D were the insights that were gathered from the conversations. There's a very famous ad campaign. Hare Krishna friends of you
here.
Conventional market researchers said they want 12 days to give a proposal and they do 2,000 interviews. Now, we gave the report in 12 days time. The time will take, if you went for the conventional methodology, is to prepare a proposal and get it accepted. Instead of doing 2,000 interviews, we analyzed 51,000 conversations. So, it changes the paradigm. PR. So there's a pharmaceutical company which had a bit of a problem and they got alerted as soon as the problem was gathering let's say some momentum in complaint sites and whatnot. So there are lots of applications there. Lead generation, there's an insurance company and a paint company which generates leads using this. So we see a whole lot of things that can be done, all actionable. So going far beyond market research, there's a very, very, very famous young people's TV channel which actually uses this hours to figure out every day, every episode, which are the characters which are syncing well or vibing well with the audience, and they decide that these are the guys they're going to promote in their ads instead of promoting arbitrarily some people or characters. They decide, okay, 4 episodes from now, how should things change because the way that people are reacting to stories. So, there's a wealth of information. There are 2 billion postings. Billion. And analyzing, fortunately, has become a big challenge. So then if you are good and your technology is very sound, you add value. It's just 5 million blocks per day as it was in 2005. You didn't need too much technology.
So here you are like an investor. Well, not really somebody who plays a hands-on role.
See, hands-on role, one knows one's limitations. My strength is in strategy. So if there is strategic input required and I'm required to be there 4 days a week, I do it. If there are times that I'm required only half a day a week, I'll spend only half a day. But I will not interfere in things which I don't know. I can give direction. So I don't know the first thing of writing code, but I know what customers might want to use it for. So we can send these guys on a wild goose chase. Why don't you think of some idea of this kind and develop a...
One of the bigger lessons that's come for me from your how this idea virtually germinated is how a simple newspaper article, and one, which triggered some thoughts in your mind, two, linking it to something else, number two, and number three, then connecting with the right kind of resource, which luckily for you happened to be your own son. Making these quick connections and putting it together into, converting it into some kind of a value prop seems to be something that you've done repeatedly in your life. So, would you think that a lot of entrepreneurs do not do enough reading, coming back to your earlier assertion on exposure, and therefore miss out on a lot of opportunities?
I will not make a statement that a lot of entrepreneurs don't do reading. Back 40 years ago, 20 years ago, even today, you'll find one section of the population does a lot of reading and a lot of others don't. All I'm saying is that if you're one of those who don't read, you're missing out a lot in life. Whether it's your just knowledge building or whether it is for your entrepreneurial work, you're missing a lot. Because when you read, you know that what you read in 1 hour, probably took 10-12 hours for someone to write, and if it was print worthy, that person must be good. So you're missing out a lot of intellectual inputs and knowledge which a lot of people are prepared, I'm saying authors are prepared to share, and they share it, and you're missing it by not reading it. You may or may not accept it after reading it. You may just throw it out of the ear. Because you might say, I don't agree with it, fine. But there's so much you can gain by reading.
Now, you've been an entrepreneur for so many years. You've done so many different things. And any time when you felt like tearing your hair out and saying, oh my God, I wish I didn't do this, you know. I should have listened to my father, mother or the others and taken up a proper corporate job. Stuff it kind of thing.
It's interesting, my father never told me what to do. Mm. That is his principle. So I never told myself what to do. At the convocation after IIT, he asked me, he just told me after the photograph of time, he says, you know, I wanted to become a doctor. I said, what? After my first year in IIT, I was so keen on becoming a doctor. I was confused and I came and asked you, you know, I really think maybe I should go and become a doctor, not an engineer. And you had no word of advice. And here you are saying, right from the time I was born, you wanted me to be a doctor. You never told me once, even when I was tilting towards it. I think that's a big thing that he didn't tell me. But when you don't tell someone what to do, the person has to have a car to figure out what to do. Then you own up the responsibility for what you did. Otherwise, you know, you can become whatever someone tells you to do, and then it doesn't work. You say, that guy told me to do it, and you gave me wrong advice, I should have not done it. But this, you do it yourself, and you know that you have to carry the can.
But anytime you felt, you know, this entrepreneurship was really not worth it, or it kind of took too much juice out of you, screwed up other parts of your life, or something like that? Completely. So one of those very happy journeys.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's always a struggle for entrepreneurs, which you seem to suggest that has not been a problem for you, is this issue of work-life balance and all that. How did you manage this over your more than 25 years as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, actually, I don't understand this concept of work-life balance. Mm. See, if you look at entrepreneurship, it's about work and passion. Then you are a successful entrepreneur. Work and no passion doesn't get you anywhere as an entrepreneur. To me, life is about living and passion. So I see more of a connect because both require passion. So I don't see a conflict. So if you're passionate about what you're doing in life and what you're doing at work, I don't know where the balance problem is. Both are contributing to the daily, you know, that juice.
So you see your work as part of your overall life, rather than necessarily as two distinct compartments. And that's the way, in your view, that you kind of got this.
Yeah, many people may disagree, but then I'm very comfortable.
So you bring the dog to work, maybe the son,
yeah. And the wife is the dog. I don't think I have to work.
Okay, now so many years have passed by, and what now for you, for Avalon, for Ugam? What else is it that you got planned?
See, these things don't get planned. One thing I'm not walking into the sunset like a good old movie, you know. I'm going to be doing something or the other. It may not be, I'm tending towards not money based. So I'm going to be working as hard as I work today, about 12 hours to 14 hours a day. But it will not be for money. That's what I see as the next thing.
But not necessarily with Avalon or Ugam. They will continue to run as independent professional businesses.
Exactly.
This will be more in terms of how you see yourself doing things. So which means one of the interesting things will be what kind of succession or other issues have you got for Avalon and Ugam?
None of the companies have any succession issue because it's built that way. Unless you have great guys under you or with you, you cannot grow. So it was great guys came in not for succession purpose, for building the business. So when you go there, they'll make a difference at all.
So you managed to create a good team who's been with you for all this long journey and created a pretty good
institution. The team is really good. If you don't have a really good team, you just cannot deliver anywhere. Because you can't be everywhere all the while. And you know, in the knowledge business, it just takes the last job to be done badly to blow off your reputation, isn't it?
So what advice, if I can call it that, or suggestions would you give to today's young entrepreneurs who are embarking on this journey as a kind of parting shot?
I wouldn't arrogate myself to be in a position to say, here's the advice, one, these five things. I would say, look, make sure you're having fun. Make sure you're doing something that you're going to enjoy. Because when you're enjoying, all the hardships are not don't appear like hardships to you. But when you're not enjoying what you're doing, even a small thing becomes a big issue. So make sure that whatever you're doing is something you're going to really enjoy and gives you tremendous satisfaction and happiness. Then, so don't get into some line of business where, oh, the money is great and let's do it. Unless you're going to enjoy that. That's all I can say.
The great
talk. There can be other more intelligent people give a philosophical twist to it. And they're saying it's just all about fun.
You want to keep it simple, Raj.
Keep it simple. Keep it simple.
Okay, and keep things going with a constant flow.
Yeah.
It's been great talking to you, Raj. Lovely, and all the best
to you.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
Folks, this was Raj Nair of Avalon Consulting in the Entrevista series with entrepreneurs. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, sir. It was very enjoyable the way you conducted it.